Bush and Richie's Daily Takeaway.
Bush and Richie's Daily Takeaway.
Absolute Radio.
Is your lad like into video games?
No. Where's my noise? Oh, we're recording. This is perfect. My boy is.
There you go.
Thank you very much. You my boy is a muser. Like, he plays drums and guitar.
Oh, wow.
A lot. And writes songs and makes music, and not necessarily what he'll do, but that's. We've done a reasonable job at gently guiding our kids into doing stuff that isn't staring passively at things. He's a bit of a gamer.
Yeah.
He likes sport, but it's not his talent, and he's very diligent.
And with the music side of things, did you give him the space to see whether he's into it or not? Because
I guess
you force anything as a parent, they're like, I'm not doing that.
No, it's hopeless. He was always just playing, like when he was tiny, he'd pick up his toy guitar and just go, bam, ba-ka-dam, gom, bum, ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka- It's like my daughter with her critical thinking. You know, she's studying philosophy now.
Oh, wow.
It's hard to tell as a parent, even in hindsight, whether you led them there or whether you followed them there.
Mm-hmm.
But I definitely don't think you can lead someone who's not. It's going to be both, isn't it? You notice in your kids certain things. You encourage it because you want your kids to feel confident.
Yeah.
And if you want your kids to feel confident, you have to say, just do the thing you do most naturally.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you're like, but you don't get to let go of your maths and you think, it's a tough balance. But my daughter's a really good actor and very, very, very good at, she's ended in the right place with philosophy and critical thinking at uni. My boy will probably be a muso, but we don't want him to think that that's the only option. So
yeah.
We'll see how we go.
Oh, wow. And do you find yourself saying phrases that your parents said to you?
I mean, I find myself parenting in the same tone my father infuriatingly parented me, which is this incredibly logical sort of calm thing that I do that drives everyone insane. But I don't know how I'm perceived. I don't spend too much time thinking about it, but I think because I'm a performer and stuff and because I have had a reputation for saying what I think, and I don't know what people imagine we're like, but I have a really quiet, we're a little pile of puppies, my family and I. There's not a lot of shouting, you know, it doesn't suit the neurotype of one of my children. It never suited Sarah or I. You know, we're just a gentle, we laugh a lot and make stupid jokes and do stupid voices, and it's...
Do you sit around the table to have dinner?
Yeah, try to.
I've always aspired to that, but we've never quite got there.
It's hard. And you think, I will definitely do that when I'm a parent, because as a kid, I was one of four and it was like dinner was sacred.
Yeah.
But the world changes and you try and you realise you're sort of being despotic in trying to make something happen that no longer sort of suits the culture we live in.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're recording anyway, aren't we? So that's because that's lovely chatting there. Tim Minchin, welcome to Home Time.
Oh, it started?
We're already on, man. It's
man,
good to
I always
to
assume
back.
Everything I say is, we're on, baby. Thanks for having me.
You're always busy whenever I've seen you. And we're just talking before we got going there that you're nearly at the end. You're nearly able to, you've done a tour and you've done a lot of interviews.
Yeah, straight into a press week, straight into this album release. But
how do you feel?
I feel good. I got through the tour really fit and well. Like, the great enemy of touring is viruses. You know, you get a cold and the sound guy gets a cold and gives it to the bass player and suddenly you're all like hanging on by your fingernails and taking cold and flu tablets to try and sing the show. My show is 2.5 hours and I talk at this rate or sing the whole time.
Wow.
It's way too long, by the way. I would not stay past the halftime, but I'm not my audience.
Have you ever had to cancel right at the last minute because of illness? Like, you know, Jeff Lynne with the ELO thing recently here in the UK.
Poor
what a nightmare.
Jeff, yeah, I cancelled a show in my very first year of touring because I had, you know, diarrhea, like I was so sick. I would not cancel that show now. I hadn't learnt that you can do it. I would rather die than cancel. I mean, that's not quite true, but I do not cancel.
Right. There are ways around it.
There will be a time when I have to, I guess, especially as I get older and I have no intention of not performing. But anyway, this tour has been amazing. I've come to the end of it fit and strong. My voice is strong. And then I tipped straight into a press week for this record. And you have to do a jet lag thing because you were sleeping 3 a.m. I get to sleep about 2 or 3 a.m. after I've performed. It just takes a while to get your head into the bed. And I sleep till 10 or 11.
Right.
And then it's like, you've got a radio, live radio at 7 a.m. And you're like, and so I'm shattered. And I haven't seen my kids for 10 weeks. I leave tomorrow night. I am so looking forward to going home and I'm so tired. But I know every time I get on the plane at Heathrow, I feel devastated to leave the UK. This is my heartland, you know.
And do you? I mean, you're born in Northampton.
Yeah.
Do you ever go? Do you have a little look around Northampton?
I have.
It's the home of shoes, right? The home of shoemaking.
It is. It's the kinky boots town. I mean, I have been back a couple of times, but when I say I was born in the UK, people assume I'm the child of parents. But I'm multi-generational Australian. My dad was at Northampton General Hospital doing his surgical fellowship when I was born.
Oh, wow. Okay.
As if they didn't have enough on their plates with my big brother and surgical fellowship. The rumour is they were culled on a train to Edinburgh. Disgusting. It's the rocking motion. That's why I swing like I do.
And then, I mean, when was the last time you went back to Northampton to have a look around?
We went through it the other day. I was like, I was born there. Oh, I did a gig there a good 10 or so years ago or more. And I don't think I don't remember. There's so much. I never know where I am in the world. Don't ask me when I was last in Northampton. I don't know when I was last in my brain.
And then when you go back and you see your kids, you haven't seen your kids for 10 weeks, do you bring them something?
Absolutely not.
Oh, I thought you might have someone in the suitcase.
Never in my life have I brought them a gift. Sometimes I make good decisions in my life. Noticing early on that given I go away a lot, that if I bring them, I remember the first time I went away from them, I thought I should take them a present. Maybe I've brought them something once or twice.
Mm.
But I went, if I take them a present, the next time I come home, their eyes will be on the suitcase, not on me. And I've never done it. So when I come, my kids have never expected a gift, ever.
Yeah.
And they're expecting me.
That's a great bit of advice. Yeah. That should be in the book, which we'll talk about in a second, to be honest with you. Well, let's talk about the record, Time Machine. Is it an album? Would you describe it as an album of, it's not lost songs. It's songs that you wrote in your 20s, like between 95
yeah,
and 2005.
Yeah, so the year I turned 30, this exact time, August 2005, I was about to be 30, I'm 50 in October, 20 years ago, I came to Edinburgh Fringe with a cabaret show of my stupid stuff. By then I knew that I knew that people were keen on this thing I was doing, this comedy thing, but it just changed my life.
Mm-hmm.
That Melbourne Comedy Festival, but mostly Edinburgh Fringe. I came over here having played 150 seats. I walked away with a promoter, an agent, a DVD deal, having played the Royal Albert Hall, you know, like having done a song at the Royal Albert Hall.
Yeah.
And then we moved over here and the rest is my own personal megalomaniacal history. but in the 10 years before that, I was doing everything I do now. I was acting and writing music, playing piano bars and cover bands and original bands and recording music and writing comedy. And all those songs written in that period, some of them came with me because they were Rock and Roll Nerd and You Grow on Me Like a Tumor and songs that fitted into my new genre, and some were left behind. This record includes both. So there's the first ever proper studio recorded versions of songs that have previously only been heard live, but live at the Royal Albert Hall during the proms and, you know, Not Perfect, which I just released a single of a couple of days ago. These songs have been in the world for years but have never been bottled as a, like, this is a studio version that you can play on the radio without audience sound. And then there's another set of songs on the record that are that didn't come with me, that were just written for various reasons at various times that I think stand the test of time.
Okay.
And then I recorded them all, in a studio in a four-day period with just four musicians. So it's band in a studio, band in a room album.
Yeah, yeah.
Overdubs, vocal and piano overdubs, spare keyboard. But basically it's got a sonic restriction, so it works as a record. It's really weird.
What was it like going back to just playing in a little band like that? It must have been amazing.
Well, I've done everything over the years. I mean, I'm not a great studio monster. I'm sort of impatient. I'm a live guy. But the musos I play with are such just mother effers, as we say in the industry. Are we swearing on Absolute Radio?
No. We encourage it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're absolute motherfuckers. And they're I don't know. It's just, we just got something. And it wasn't my intention to make a vinyl and do a press tour and get to number four on the charts or whatever I am this week. Don't worry about it. You know, 21-year-old me would just absolutely poop himself. I thought it was just like, oh, we'll record these old songs because my fans should have access to good versions of them. Yeah. And then my record company was like, man, this is an album. It's a bit of a interesting sort of idea, this time machine, you know?
And then, I mean, how do you feel about, you know, like when people pick up a song that was never meant to be heard?
Yeah.
Like, what do you do with songs? You know, like they've done it with the Beatles where they've picked up stuff that was like on the cutting room floor and you think, surely they didn't want that out.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How'd you delete those songs?
They did
you don't
it to
like?
Jeff Buckley and Prince and all this stuff that those artists had chosen not to release.
How'd you delete a song that you want to try and make sure it doesn't see the light of day?
I mean, if only we lived in a world where you could leave your past behind, but that world is gone, my friend.
It certainly is.
I don't have shame about anything, but yeah, I really think I should have autonomy over my work. We'll see what happens when I die, which could be in the next 24 hours, the way I'm feeling now. Could just keel over.
But you're an incredible lyricist, and Time Machine, as part of the press package for this, they had this lovely thing with all the lyrics.
Oh, did
out,
they? Oh, gorgeous.
Which is incredible. And it kind of reminded me of a long-forgotten process of making mixtapes for people. You know, because the songs seem very personal, written about, seems like you had someone in mind.
It's a bit of a document of a time, yeah.
It is. And, when you look, I guess it's a thing that I don't think we'll ever do it again. Will you record a cassette of different songs? And write the stuff.
I mean, now it's a Spotify playlist, right?
But if someone sends you a playlist, you're like, oh, give me a break. I haven't got time to listen to that. I hate it when people send me a Spotify playlist.
Yeah,
I mean,
it was a gift. A mixtape was a very personal gift.
Yeah.
I mean, I like it when people give me books for the same reason. Like, I like this. You might like this. It's a Time Machine. I love my lyrics written out because I'm... Especially because when I started writing lyrics like this, these sort of quirky, rejoicing in the playfulness of words... Not, you know, in the 90s when we came through, it was like, you know, the more obscure your lyrics were, the cooler, you know. Oh, you read into them what you will, which is like a lot of poetry. It's like non-didactic. It's not saying this is what it's about. And the artist would be like, you know, the listener can read into it what they will, you know. Means one thing to me and another to... All good. I was always like, this is what the song's about. This is the point I'm trying to make. This is what I think love is like. This is. I was always didactic as I am as a person. It's annoying. But I was always sort of ashamed of that. Like, I was sort of nerdy. It was nerdy lyrics. And now I've been doing it for 30 years, and it's almost like it's fine now because it's my own genre. And because of things like Matilda and stuff, I'm now known as a lyricist in my own mode that is good. I now look at all these lyrics and, like, they were always good. They were always fine. I just didn't have the courage of my convictions, nor should I if I was a young man. It's appropriate that I... didn't, but now I'm like, they were fine, mate. You're all right. Let's put them out.
They're great, and they look amazing on a page and everything as well. Yeah. And I mean, you're a composer, you're a man of high culture, but when you're away from the public eye, when you finally get home, Tim, what's the most lowbrow, basic thing that you enjoy doing?
It's a great question, and I sometimes come across as I don't watch telly, and I've never watched reality TV. So you know, the guilty pleasure question is, I really like reading novels. Like, you know, men tend to read nonfiction, and as they get older, more and more nonfiction.
Yeah.
I've gone the other way. I'm just so tired of how stressful the world is and maybe a bit tired of trying to be a polymath and whatever the insecurity's driven me to try and take in all this information and understand everything and be able to articulate my ideas in every direction. I'm just like, so tired. I want like a crime thriller. I read a lot of like what they call contemporary women's fiction, which we used to call chick lit.
Yeah.
I love a rom-com. I love a bad rom-com movie. I rewatched How to Lose a Guy in 10 Dates the other day, 10 days, and it was really good. It's one of the better rom-coms. I like, you know, I read my Jack Reacher. I read good novels as well, but...
So on the plane, when you get on the plane later on, that's going to be what you...
Oh, I would just watch filth, but...
so to speak.
Filth. And by the way, I there are levels of bad movies that I cannot stomach and feel angry about. Lowbrow. I mean, you know, I certainly am not high cult. I don't sort of read. I don't listen to classical music. I don't listen to any music. I'm not. I'm definitely not high culture, but I'm not particularly lowbrow either. I'm kind of like. I like jogging and drinking coffee and sitting with my dog, and I'm just trying to find I mean, as you can, if you can imagine, the way I speak is like there's three voices like that in my head the whole time. My mission is to do things that don't fire me up. So everyone says I should meditate, and I'm like, oh God, I can't think of any worse. But I do jog. That's my thing.
And let's talk about the book, which is fantastic. I've been reading it on the way and on the train today.
Oh, good man.
You don't have to have a dream. It's superb. It's kind of an incredible collection of, so three speeches that you've given at universities.
That's exactly right.
Starts in the University of Western Australia in
2013.
Mm-hmm. And you give the speeches known as the Nine Life Lessons.
Yes, exactly.
And the great advice, like, don't seek happiness, remember it's all luck, etc.
Yeah.
When I was reading it, I was like, this is a fantastic tonic to the rise of the influencer. You know, these people are out there who are kind of giving you a fast route to success. Follow me, pay for what I do. And,
or the myth that success is the right thing to aim for.
Well, yeah, exactly.
You know, success, what does that mean? And the idea that everyone can be president. It's not even appropriate that everyone should think about being president. It's a stupid idea. Like, I mean, the president shouldn't be president. Come on. That's a very 2018 joke, isn't it? Yeah, I was, even then, it was the year I turned 38, so it's a good little while ago now.
Mm.
Quite interesting how it's stood up. Like, there's stuff in it that feels like it's really written for now, you know, don't compare yourself to others, and lots of stuff about you're dispelling the pop culture myths of exactly as you say, the sort of nonsense that we see on social media, like everyone's going to be... Everyone can be anything if they only believe in it. And I've always been inclined to try to deconstruct myths, sometimes in a way that I don't know if I still believe in, but all my love songs are deconstructing myths, pop cultural myths about love. And and even Groundhog Day is, as a musical, is sort of deconstructing the myth of life having a meaning. It says you have to create your meaning by being kind to community and stuff. I think one thing I'm proud of with that book is I wrote some essays, and I realized as I was writing, putting that book together, that there is cohesiveness.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I'm not unchanging. I hope I'm not someone who doesn't know how to change their opinions. I don't think so. It's in the book. You be hard on your opinions, be willing to change when introduced to new ideas. But there's definitely a cohesive, basically sort of scientific method born. Meaning is constructed of the stories we tell ourselves about ourselves. Kind, be kind to people, even if you really disagree with them.
Mm.
It's all, I feel like I've comported myself reasonably over a reasonably long career. And I think the book reflects a worldview that I back, a sort of non-spiritual but nevertheless love-filled worldview.
And we are, I mean, you mentioned it yourself, we're kind of hit with such a bombardment, a bewildering array of bad news after bad news.
Yes.
Does the book hold up? Would you view to write it again now? Would you change anything given how, you know, life, being alive, being aware sometimes is actually stressful in itself?
Yes, maybe. I think what's comforting about my worldview is that, and it says it in the essays, it has built-in change. So the thing I believe most is that you should allow information to change your beliefs. It's mm-hmm. why I'm an atheist and stuff, because I'm not inclined towards doctrine or dogma. Anything that is codified in a book that says this is how we have to be, to me personally, restricts the possibility that we're completely wrong about that and should adjust. And so my worldview is really based on a scientific worldview that we can stumble towards truth, taking into account all the evidence that comes before us. And but with the humility of knowing that our brains and our psychology, so I call it neuropsychological humility, understanding our brains trick us, mm-hmm. confirmation, all our biases, the communities we're in, the nonsense we read on Insta, it's all going to make you an imperfect observer.
Yep.
So that's what science is. It's right. You know, we observe the world, but we have to have humility about our biases. And I don't know, it sounds boring on the radio, but it makes me excited.
No, it's fascinating. And I read in, I think it's in the prologue about the fact that people have cut pieces of it out and stuck it on the wall or on the fridge. What an amazing thing, though,
It is amazing. I mean, I've loved the 20 years that since things started going well for me. I've loved my whole career. I'm a I'm not really trained. I come from Perth, West Australia. I don't come from a musical family. I can't read music. I never studied musical theatre or comedy or acting, or, and I've got to do all these things. And I find that unbelievably cool. But more than anything, I didn't expect that there'd be millions of British school kids singing When I Grow Up at their Christmas concert and their parents crying, or that White Wine in the Sun would become a Christmas song that most Australians know. I mean, it's when you, without planning, put something out there that slowly embeds itself in culture. And my stuff never comes out with a splash because I don't have a massive record. You'll never see me on billboards. You'll barely see me on the telly. You know, there's no advertising. Mm-hmm. I just put stuff out there, and every now and then one of them just twists in and twists in and twists in, and suddenly it's culture.
Yeah.
And that, I mean, I think I'm really proud of that. Like, and with some of these life lessons, which I didn't mean as a top-down thing. Mostly they're just like things I have to remind myself of all the time. Yeah, some of them are fridge magnets.
That's great.
That's all I've ever aspired to.
Yeah, you made it. But it's out in September and it is amazing. We're celebrating a Britpop summer here at Absolute Radio, a kind of love letter to music of that era from the mid-90s.
Please.
A great decade for British bands. What impact, if any, has Britpop had on you then, Tim?
Oh, I think it was huge. I'm not sure how it changed my music, because I'm really dumb about influences. I can never quite figure out what came from where. But Britpop is huge for us. Oasis and Blur and it was a huge part of the era where Sarah and I met and fell in love. I've been with the same person since that era, and mm-hmm. we're marinated in it.
I love that. And do you have a preference? I know there was a big battle between Oasis and Blur. Which side would you be on?
Nah, I don't care. I tell you, I am a bit of a live music puritan. I have big, strong beliefs about what one's job is as a musician.
Okay.
Like, you asked if I ever cancelled a show. Like, every time I walk on stage, I think there's someone out there who has saved and scrimped and to be there, and I will not let them down. And so when the boys were doing all their fighting and cancelling, and I was just like, that put me off. Maybe it was just the press, but it put me off Oasis a bit, because I wanted to say, it's not about you. It's never about you. It's about them. And as I say, it sounds very purist or something, but I really believe that. And I love to hear that they're out there, like they are getting on stage every night and they know exactly what their job is and they're doing it and they're leaving there. Whatever they've got there, that's not what it's about. And that makes me think, good on you.
Amazing. Well, listen, it's been brilliant to have you on the show. I will let you catch that flight and get home and see your kids and put your feet up and stroke the dog and have a coffee. So let's just recap then. Time Machine, the album of those previously unreleased songs, is out now. Go and buy it. It's superb. Tim Minchin, thank you so much.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bush and Richie's Daily Takeaway.
Absolute Radio.